Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New England is not immune to white supremacist groups like those who gathered in Virginia over the weekend. There are half a dozen such organizations based in New Hampshire, according to those who track these movements. Meanwhile, just to our south in Boston, a so-called free speech rally planned for Saturday may be canceled, with some participants saying they have nothing to do with the likes of those in Charlottesville. Still, at a press conference yesterday, city leaders basically said, don't come. Here's Mayor Marty Walsh.
Boston does not welcome you here. Boston does not want you here. Boston rejects your message. We reject racism. We reject white supremacy. We reject anti-Semitism. We reject the KKK. We reject neo-Nazis. We reject domestic terrorism, and we reject hatred. And we will do every single thing in our power to keep hate out of our city.
Today in The Exchange, we're gauging your reaction to what we saw in Virginia. And while it's easy to point fingers down south, we're looking at our own backyard, at racism and anti-Semitism in our own communities. Join us. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests in the studio, and we'll be bringing in other voices throughout the hour. With me now are Rabbi Edward Boraz of the Dartmouth College Hillel, associate chaplain at Dartmouth. He also serves as the rabbi for Congregation Kol HaEmek in the Upper Valley. And Rabbi Boraz, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is the Right Reverend Robert Hirschfeld. He's bishop of the Episcopal Church of New Hampshire. And Bishop Hirschfeld, good to have you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Reverend Eric Jackson, pastor at Brookside Congregational Church in Manchester, also president of the Greater Manchester branch of the NAACP. And Reverend Jackson, thank you also for being here. I really appreciate it. Everybody came in last minute. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, first of all, to you, Reverend Jackson, but to everybody, how are you processing all this?
A lot of ways. It's deeply saddening to see what's taken place in Charlottesville and what seems to be popping up in other parts of the country, such as in the planned rally in Boston. There was another Patriot Party coming up, and they called it a Patriot Prayer or something in California. A lot of it is just so disillusioning. But on the other hand, though, it seems like this, what we all feared, especially with the advent of this administration, with people feeling emboldened and empowered to express these disbeliefs and to utilize and employ hate speech, that all of this is starting to really come to fruition now.
How are your congregants feeling? What are they talking to you about?
What I'm hearing is, I'm hearing two things. One, I'm hearing the sadness, but then I get a call from a parishioner yesterday and said, "Where's the next march at? I'm ready to march."
I'm ready to march and be a counter.
I'm ready to engage in some counter protest and activism.
Do people feel scared? They feel like they have a target on their back?
Say some more about that.
Well, just that, some of these groups very clearly do not like African Americans, do not like Jewish people, and they're pretty heavily armed.
Yeah, I would say there are some out there who, you definitely feel that sense of, you don't know who holds what value or how someone really feels. But at the same time, I don't believe I can live my life in fear, because there, what I saw at St. Paul's Church on Sunday night was over 300 to 400 people who were committed to justice and equality. So that gives me a lot of hope, and I think that hope certainly outweighs any fear that these protesters, these terrorists, can ever try to incite or evict inside any one of us.
Rabbi Boris, how about you? How are you sorting through all this? A lot of anti-Jewish sentiment at that rally, a lot of Nazi symbols.
Well, whenever there's a Nazi symbol that that strikes at the heart of our people, to really understand it, one has to really take a step back. Last night, I talked to students, and I would say without hesitation that all of us stand against, you know, KKK and white, and we stand together as a people who believe in freedom, who believe in the pursuit of happiness, and that everyone is created equal, and that everyone is created in the divine image, and therefore deserve to be treated in that way. And I think what we saw in Charlottesville and the speech that was engaged there and what these hate groups stand for is just antithetical to that. As someone who has been to Eastern Europe with students many times, both at Auschwitz and in shtetls where there are no more Jewish people, we can see the end game of those of the product of that philosophy, and it's a tragic one.
The Holocaust Memorial, by the way, in Boston was shattered again yesterday for the second time since the summer, and city officials said that it's been up since the mid-90s and has never been a problem until this year.
Yeah. Well, we're seeing, again, the exercise of freedom of speech, not in the tearing down of the, or, you know, not the destruction of the Holocaust Memorial, but as Reverend Jackson pointed out, there's a sense of empowerment, I think, that is going on with these far-right hate groups, and I'm not quite sure what to attribute that to, but the expression of free speech is something that we value deeply, and at the same time, when we hear this kind of rhetoric, which I think in part is an outgrowth of the kind of rhetoric that we heard during the campaign. These sort of personal attacks and language that we had not heard before. I think this is an extension of that, unfortunately, in terms of people feeling empowered and also feeling empowered in terms of their right to say whatever it is that they want to say, regardless of how hurtful and how antithetical it is to our Constitution and our relationship to one another.
Well, we will, a little bit later in the program, talk to a free speech First Amendment expert at UNH Law. But I want to ask you, Rabbi Boras, the same question I asked Reverend Jackson. Do Jewish students feel safe?
Yes. In talking to them last night at our Monday night meeting and in my informal discussions, I think students feel as safe as they can be. You know, they're not walking around in fear. They stand proudly, as well as the Jewish community does, against this sort of thing. And also we feel a great deal of support. President Hanlon, on behalf of Dartmouth College, just issued a statement, a very strong statement, condemning all of this type of rhetoric that's coming from KKK and white supremacists, as well as, of course, the anti-Semitic statements. So there's a sense that we stand together.
Bishop Hirschfeld, I'd love to hear from you, too, how you're just working through this, what conversations you've had with people in your church.
Well, there's just a sense of real deep dismay that this has happened, even though we have begun in the Episcopal Church some serious conversations about structural racism in our society and our own complicity in that, as primarily in New Hampshire, we are congregations made up of white privileged people in New Hampshire. So we're beginning to have conversations about that. So even as those conversations have begun, there's a sense in which there's just deep, deep disappointment because we thought we were making progress, even with the setbacks of the past year since the presidential campaign. So we're going back to our baptismal covenant, which we make vows at, and we renew these vows to uphold the dignity of every human being, and who we believe are created in the image of God. And we are now feeling more emboldened to speak out against this kind of rhetoric, these kinds of actions. So it was deeply, even if it was so disheartening and dismaying and repugnant, what we heard out of Charlottesville, the experience of Sunday night gathering with people of many faiths and races to come together and to feel as though we're not alone in combating this.
Well, all of you have mentioned the election. Some of you mentioned the administration. The president did have something to say yesterday, some pretty strong words condemning what we saw in Charlottesville, specifically condemning groups like the KKK and neo-Nazi groups. Let's play a little bit of what the president said yesterday.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. It has no place in America. And as I have said many times before, no matter the color of our skin, we all live under the same laws. We all salute the same great flag. And we are all made by the same Almighty God.
Again, that's President Trump speaking yesterday about the violence we saw in Charlottesville, Virginia. Today in The Exchange, we are processing this here in New Hampshire. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. After what we saw in Charlottesville, people in this region are looking more closely at local racist and anti-Semitic groups, their statements, their plans. We're talking about that and just gauging your overall reaction to what happened this weekend. So join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So Bishop Hirschfeld, at the end of that clip, and I want to hear from everybody on this, the president referenced, you know, the Almighty God, and it makes me wonder, what is your role as a faith leader in this issue, especially in a state that is routinely ranked as number one or number two as the least religious? I mean, you can make the most beautiful sermon ever, but if nobody hears it, what good does it do? So I just wonder what your thoughts are, and I want to hear from everybody on that, too. But go ahead, Bishop Hirschfeld.
Well, we have, as I said, this baptismal vow, which we take seriously and we quote often, and even those who are not terribly religiously observant, even among the Episcopalians, found themselves going back to those vows. How do we uphold the dignity of every human being? How do we seek and serve Christ in all persons, loving our neighbor as ourselves? This is sort of the bedrock of our ethos as a church, and so we find ourselves coming back to this. And it becomes a theological, spiritual issue. I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a sociologist. So I find that we have to summon the courage to have these conversations about why we are so afraid. What keeps us? What is the source of our fear? And because I think fear is the close cousin of hatred. So that's what we're trying to accomplish in the congregations.
How about you, Reverend Jackson? Again, as a faith leader, how do you become a leader in this or create a message that people will listen to in a relatively unchurched state like New Hampshire?
I think there are some universal principles that transcend just one faith tradition but yet are held sacred in each of them individually. Such as uphold, like in the United Church of Christ, our General Minister and President John Dorhauer rolled out a vision and a new model for the UCC, which talks about the three great loves: love of children, love of neighbor, and love of creation. And I think those are values that transcend across the denominational or even the lines of one particular faith community. And I think upholding something as so broad but yet so sacred as love, I think that is how, as a faith leader, is one way that I can be able to make a difference and reach those who may not be part of my tradition in a state like New Hampshire. because I think that's something we can all resonate with, the need for justice, the need for love, and the need for equality. And I think that's something that's found in my faith tradition and in others.
Do you think in this, again, relatively non-religious state, we trade back and forth with Vermont in terms of adhering to mainstream religions, do you think non-religious people, Reverend Jackson, are ready to listen to you and people, the other people on this panel, or do you think they feel like you guys aren't talking to me?
I've spoken at a number of rallies and protests since I've been here as been here serving in New Hampshire, and I found that there are a lot of people who don't go to church who do attend the vigils, will attend rallies, and will be out on the front lines. And I find them to be some of the best listeners out there because they listen to every word and hold on to it and evaluate.
Go ahead, Bishop Hirschfeld, and then Rabbi Boies, go ahead.
I really agree with that. The congregation at St. Paul's Church on Sunday is evidence of that. And that there were – what was interesting about that event was it was the most integrated racially event that I've seen in one of our churches in a very long time. And it reflects what our own presiding bishop, Michael Curry, is urging us to imagine is becoming the beloved community. What does that mean? Not only in our faith community, but in the wider society.
Go ahead, Rabbi Boies. I'd love to hear from you on that, too. I mean, you know, you've got a message, but is anybody there to hear it?
Well, yes, I think people do hear it, and they hear it in different ways, and they hear it at different times. I think from our tradition, one of the passages that come from our faith tradition is that there's a discussion, whereas we hold that mitzvot, commandments, are very important coming from the Torah, there's a discussion about human dignity. Does human dignity override all of the commandments in the Torah? That if something is done for the sake of human dignity, can you set aside other religious practices? And the answer to that seems to be yes. In other words, that one of the core things that that are in Judaism is this notion, number one, of human dignity. And that transcends the Jewish people, that transcends, that embraces all of humankind. The second thing, I think the second message that we try to tell our people and those who come into the Roth Center, which is a place that's welcoming for everyone, is the notion of justice. That's a core value within our faith tradition, as it is in all faith traditions. There's a phrase in Hebrew, tzedek, tzedek tirdov, justice, justice you shall vigorously pursue. And it's interesting that the word pursuit is there because justice is a pursuit. Justice and fundamental fairness for every human being is something that I think we as a society must have always striven for and will continue to strive for. And finally, that the idea is not to just sit in a synagogue and pray, but to go out and actually do something about it, to be committed to social justice, to making the world a better place. And just one last thing that gives us some existential encouragement. There's a statement that's in the Bible, I think it's in the book of Deuteronomy, that talks about poverty. And it says on the one hand that your land will be fruitful and that and you'll eat and you'll be satisfied, and also there will be those who are hungry in the land. And those who are hungry in the land, that you must always feed them, you must always nurture them, but that hunger that there will always be poverty in the land. And so you have to commit yourself all the time to justice and to those values because they are, because they're always going to be challenged. And I think that's what we're facing today.
Coming up, we'll talk a lot more with our panel, and got lots of emails, calls coming in, so we'll take your questions and comments for sure. We'll also talk to a free speech expert at UNH Law, and a little bit later, the Vice President for Institutional Diversity and Equity at Keene State College will be with us. So all that's coming up. Keep it right here. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477.
Thank you.
after nearly 30 years of sound advice.
Yeah, bite the bullet. Don't fix this car anymore.
I mean,
you already got the girl, man. The car did it.
And reliable laughs.
I've come to realize that it's a big, beautiful piece of junk.
We bid farewell to the Tappet Brothers of Car Talk. Help celebrate decades of enjoyment by donating your old piece of junk to NHPR. Find out how at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sorting through all the issues and emotions that have come up since a white supremacist rally turned violent in Virginia. New England is not immune to these groups or their ideology. We're talking about that and a lot more. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Reverend Eric Jackson, pastor at Brookside Congregational Church in Manchester, also president of the Greater Manchester Branch of the NAACP. Also with us, the Right Reverend Robert Hirschfeld, bishop of the Episcopal Church of New Hampshire, and Rabbi Edward Boraz of the Dartmouth College Hillel, associate chaplain at Dartmouth College, and also the rabbi for Congregation Kol HaEmek in the Upper Valley. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. And April joins us from Dover. Hi, April. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It was interesting to be sort of on hold and listening. And one of the things that came up is social justice and doing a better good for our country and for the world. But the thing that struck me the most yesterday in listening to the president's speech was one of the things that he said was, we're all created by the same God. And that really struck me as really falling far from the mark of what he was supposed to be saying. I mean, from what I understand, only 70% of Americans are Christian, so that leaves out a whole 30% of people that they're not being included in his speech. Once again, I feel he's leaving this diversity aside.
Well, and what did you want really, him to say, April? He said a lot more than I played in that clip, but yeah, go ahead. What did you want to hear?
Yes, I know, and honestly, I didn't listen to the entire speech. I did listen to that part yesterday, and it just struck me as I guess it angered me less than humorous, but this is a man who's calling for less violence and for people to be peacefully, coexisting within the country. And yet his speech to the police was to use more force and to be more violent and, has a history of leaving out, diversity and inclusiveness in the way that he conducts himself, and has proven to be somebody who violates women.
So not trusting the president as somebody who's a spokesperson for this. April, thank you for the call. I got another email this morning from Matt in Vermont, who feels a little differently from April. Matt says, in my opinion, the liberal media immediately politicized a tragedy in an effort to attack the president. Matt says the shooter at the Republican baseball practice was a Bernie supporter. The Pulse nightclub shooter was a Democrat, he says. No responsible journalist tied these people to their political preferences. Matt says, today on NPR, your shows cast a wide net saying Trump did not respond quickly or forcefully enough. Predictably, when he did make a formal announcement, perhaps after gathering more facts, it was said that he was too little, too late. And Matt, I thank you also for the comments. Now, you mentioned in your email, Matt, NPR shows. This is the first time The Exchange has discussed this. We did play that clip of the president, and there is a lot more to it. Our goal with our program this morning, Matt and April and everyone, is not to bash politicians, but to give our listeners a space to say what they think. So, April, thank you. Matt, thank you. And you can join us as well at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email like Matt did, or give us a call like April did. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. All of you, the whole free speech issue has come up time and time again with this rally and with other planned rallies. And for more on that, I want to go to Buzz Scher. He's a professor at UNH Law and chair of the International Criminal Law and Justice Programs. Buzz is also chair and president of the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union. And Buzz, nice to have you. Welcome back.
Nice to be back, by the way. No longer chair and president.
Okay.
Retired chair and president, but
still on the board?
ACLU member. Not even on the board. I'm an active member.
Okay. Thank you for that, Buzz. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about this idea of free speech. Some of these groups are saying, hey, we're just all about free speech. What is protected, Buzz, and what isn't?
Easy question, a difficult answer, but broadly, speech is protected, conduct is not protected. So basically the way the First Amendment has been interpreted over the years in many different incidents is you can't regulate speech based on its content. So if someone says something mean, you can't, or is going to have a rally. You know, the classic example is the Skokie case in 1977, where neo-Nazis applied for a permit to march in Skokie, Illinois, which had a high percentage of people who were Holocaust survivors. So a intensely provocative march on their part. And eventually the Illinois Supreme Court said, they can march. You can't deny them the right to march based on the content of their speech.
So speech is protected. Conduct is not. Here's a question for you, Buzz. If speech makes other people feel threatened and they're afraid to go to school, they're afraid to go to work, they walk around town feeling like they have a target on their back, you know, because they're African-American or Latino or Jewish, is that speech that makes that person feel like they can't leave their house safely, is that still protected?
The short answer is yes, it still is protected. It becomes more vulnerable to being regulated if it is, it speaks of an imminent threat. So the classic example is shouting fire in a theater or pointing a gun at somebody and saying, I'm going to shoot you. But generalized, I hate LGBT people, I hate Jews, I hate African Americans, I hate Latinos, and that makes all those groups feel insecure, and they're going to march and say that during their march. That does not, that kind of speech is not going to get regulated. That is, that's what free speech is all about, and it's a difficult proposition because it's painful to listen to this. You know, one of my two reactions to what happened last weekend, in thinking back as a lawyer and a law professor, I had two images. I had Nazis marching at night in the 1930s in Germany with torches. I mean, it was very evocative of that. And it was also the desire to regulate them by saying, well, they could be violent, brought me back to the civil rights marches in the 1950s and 1960s, where one of the ways Southern police departments tried to stop them is to say, we're afraid that white people in this community are going to get violent when these civil rights marchers come into town, even though they're professing nonviolence. You know, both of those circumstances are really challenging and make us remember we need to be really careful about giving the government authority to say what speech can be regulated and what speech can't be regulated.
Well, Buzz, there's been a lot of talk about this, as you know, that, you know, whether the First Amendment is being used by some of these groups to freely intimidate people. And Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker talked about this yesterday at a press conference. Let's hear.
Freedom of speech is a founding principle of our great nation. And while this right has served us well, often promoting unity and tolerance, it can also be wielded as a weapon of divisiveness and hatred, as we saw in Charlottesville. With this right comes responsibility, and in Massachusetts, we accept the responsibility to loudly reject any forms of hatred and bigotry.
Again, that's Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker. So, Buzz, what is the responsibility?
the responsibility amongst everybody. I mean, the First Amendment principle of free speech carries deep responsibility for everybody, for people who are listening to hate speech and insulting speech and mean speech and bigoted speech. It requires responsibility to respond appropriately, not to respond with violence. And it requires the people engaged in hate speech or bigoted speech or racist speech not to act on those principles and not to act with violence. And in this world of right after Charlottesville, that's really hard. I was talking with a friend named Rob at the coffee this morning, and he's very supportive of free speech. He says, "God, I hate these people. Isn't there something we can do about this?" And we had a long conversation on this very topic. I mean, it's really painful to listen to this hate speech. But our responsibility is not to act with violence to that pain. Intimidating speech, unless there's imminent, emphasis on imminent, immediate violence following it, is not to be regulated. It's
so
a painful proposition to accept.
So if someone's Jewish, for example, and they, you know, have a neighbor who has Nazi flags all over the house and is constantly shouting, you know, anti-Jewish epithets at them when they walk out the door, they have to put up with that?
Depending on the circumstance.
Do they have rights as well to feel comfortable?
It could be qualify as disorderly conduct. It could be qualified as a form of harassment. You know, practically speaking, it very much depends on the circumstance. Remember, the Skokie case, you know, it's a really good example of neo-Nazis professing Nazi beliefs, marching in a community filled with Holocaust survivors. That could not be regulated. The irony of it was, once they got their permit, they never marched. They ended up marching in Chicago itself, and nobody paid attention to them. So, yes, if somebody is yelling in your face insults, it could count as disorderly conduct. But generally, having Nazi symbols outside your house.
Buzz, did we lose you there?
Can't be regulated by
okay.
the town now.
Okay, and Buzz, actually, I want to jump in because Rabbi Boris wants to jump in with you, and then I have another question for Reverend Jackson.
Sure,
but go ahead.
Yeah, no, I will say that I was a second-year law student in Chicago at the time when that happened. And so I remember those events quite well.
The Skokie March.
Yes, and the Jewish community outrage. And the focus really was on the pain of the number of Holocaust survivors who had who lived in Skokie. And the sight of Nazis marching down the street would be traumatic for them, obviously. What they had experienced is beyond description, of course. But at the end of the day, the Illinois Supreme Court ruled, of course, as we've just heard, and they ended up not marching, which was very, you know, they decided for some reason not to. Now, I think there's a difference, and I think we need to be careful about the Skokie case, because it seemed that group was much smaller, somewhat insignificant in terms of numbers. Here, what we saw in Charlottesville was much more organized and had greater numbers than the group that had done in Skokie. But nevertheless, the principle has stood for all these years is that people, even if it's hate speech, have a right to express it.
Well, and here's another question I wanted to ask you, Reverend Jackson. Picking up on something that Buzz said, I think you said, Buzz, that the Skokie group ended up marching in Chicago and no one paid attention. Is that what you said?
Yes, generally speaking.
Yeah, so here's a question that's also come up a lot, Reverend Jackson. I'd love to get your thought. What would happen if counter-protesters didn't show up? A lot of people have said after this in Charlottesville, hey, when these, you know, white supremacists show up, I'll be there. I'll be a counter-protester. What if counter-protesters didn't show up and just let them have their protest and ignored them?
I think that what would happen is, I think that's what I think in a lot of ways it enables. Mm-hmm. It enables. It's a form of silence. And anytime we are silent about injustice, anytime we are silent in the face of hatred, I believe we give it license to perpetuate itself and to fester.
So go ahead, Bishop Herschel. Yeah.
Well, there's something about that case, the Skokie case, and what you just mentioned, is that the culture found, the culture rallied, the wider culture, it became hostile. It became an environment where it was no longer hospitable to exercise this kind of speech and to show up in this way. And that's one of the heartening things that we're seeing, is that there's such an outrage about this. And so it makes me wonder, what is it that the religious communities have to do, and what we perhaps have failed to do, to create an environment where, when there are these incidences, that it makes them feel less hospitable, that they're and we have to say, this, you've crossed a line.
Because somebody said yesterday, I can't remember who it was, Reverend Jackson, you know, if you just ignore these folks, maybe they'll go away. But you're saying, no, that's not the case.
No. I think time and time again, we see that.
Yeah, hold on, Buzz. Yeah, go ahead, Reverend Jackson.
I think time and time again, we see what happens when we just ignore things and we allow them, and we assume that, okay, just because we're ignoring it, that the problem will just go away. Throughout history, there have been many incidents that have been, quote unquote, like, you know, people have just ignored. Take, for example, there was a story that I heard one time about in Europe, in Germany, during the Holocaust, about how the train went past on the railroad tracks. And, you know, they just ignored it. And the church said, we just heard this weird sound on Sunday, and lots of screaming on Sunday, and we just started singing louder. And then next week we started singing louder. And, you know, people were taken, their lives were being taken, and they were being burned. So I think ignoring a problem, ignoring a situation, ignoring injustice, only allows it to perpetuate and to fester. Because eventually, hateful rhetoric will lead to hateful action.
Bashir, I got to let you go. I really appreciate you joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. That's Bashir, again, a professor at UNH Law. Rabbi Boras, go ahead, jump in.
Yes, I wanted to respond just with a kind of cautionary thing about in terms of responding. I think we also have to be judicious in terms of how we respond. And I hate to use the word pick our spots, so to speak, mm-hmm. but to really be effective in that message, because the medium in which we exist can create messages that we don't want. So, for example, perhaps the counter-protesters, and I don't know, I wasn't there, you know, and I can't really comment on that, but perhaps a separate demonstration at a different time might have been a more powerful message than a counter-demonstration. Now, that's not true in every case, and people have to make that call. But I think that we as leaders have to be judicious in terms of when and where we respond.
Reverend Jackson, yeah.
Yeah, and I agree. We have to be very, you know, we have to use tact. We have to be careful, and we have to be very clear about the message that that we are trying to send. But it's just that I think that we've seen this before. And in a lot of ways, it brings up so many wounds for people. And I think that when you have a rally like that happening, I think when you look at the picture and you have a group of people.
Oh, Reverend
there,
Jackson, I do apologize. I'm gonna let you finish that up after a short break.
Ooh, all right.
All right. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, after a white supremacist rally in Virginia turned deadly over the weekend, there's heightened awareness of these racist and anti-Semitic groups in this region and what reaction we've seen across the state to the events in Charlottesville. Let's get your thoughts, questions, comments 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Reverend Jackson, sorry to interrupt you there. Just before the break, we were talking about what's the right approach for counter-protesters. I asked you earlier what would happen if nobody showed up to counter-protest, and you all pretty much said people need to show up. But then you and Rabbi Boers were having a conversation about what's the right way to do this. So go ahead, I want to let you finish there.
So in summation of what I was saying earlier, there, you know, counter-protests are, I think the counter-protests are important, but I think going to what the rabbi was saying in our conversation, in reflecting on our conversation, what I believe the right kind of counter-protest is, yes, we show up, but we make sure we're very clear with our message and to emphasize the importance of nonviolent direct action.
Well, Jeff sent us an email in Portsmouth. He says, I'm curious what the panel thinks of the Antifa group. They use violence as a method of making a point. Their methods seem to run counter to their message. So is that kind of what you're talking about, Reverend Jackson? Don't use violence to counter violence speech?
Right. I would say we don't use violence to counter hate speech.
Bishop Hirschfeld, go ahead. I'd love your thoughts on this, too.
Well, there is just it becomes a race to the bottom if it just becomes one violent response to a violent incident. Then you know we're going nowhere. And the power of the civil rights movement was that it was really built on nonviolent principles, and people were trained and organized to respond to clubs and tear gas and dogs and water cannons with nonviolence. You know, yesterday marked the 52nd anniversary of the martyrdom of Jonathan Daniels, New Hampshire's own Jonathan Daniels, who went to Hayneville, Alabama, and placed himself in front of a shotgun and took the blast. And he was committed to this vision that we are all one. We are all inexplicably, indelibly one.
Bunch of emails have come in, gentlemen. Here's one from Gabriel, who says, I see a huge double standard in the press of their treatment of violent far-right protesters versus the radical left. Gabriel says, anyone who's been paying attention knows these far-left groups have been responsible for far more violence and destruction. Many in the crowd that was run down the other day were carrying bats, pipes, and other weapons. That indicates they were prepared to do serious bodily harm. The car could have been just as easily driven by a far-left activist into the white supremacist crowd. And if it had, I suspect the press would be treating it quite differently. Gabriel said Trump was right to condemn violence and hatred on all sides. So there's Gabriel. And then we've got John, who says, you played the clip of Trump speaking yesterday, but please remember his denouncement of white supremacy was preceded by him once again touting what he perceives as his accomplishments. Only then did he attempt to denounce these hate groups. Too little, too late, and not sincere. John says, I cannot believe in 2017 we're having to fight white supremacy in the USA. You know, that was a sentiment expressed earlier this week by New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu. Let's hear what Governor Sununu said.
It's absolutely disgusting. That kind of racism, you know, this white supremacy stuff, it's just, there's absolutely no place for it. And it's appalling to me that in the year 2017, we're even having this conversation, but unfortunately we do. It's important that everybody step up and make sure that those that would portray such hatred, there's no place for that. Not in Virginia, not in New Hampshire, not anywhere in this country.
Again, that's Governor Chris Sununu. And Gabriel and John, thank you for the emails. You can email us as well, exchange at nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Now, all of you don't need me to tell you this. These issues we're talking about, race, hate speech, anti-Semitism, white supremacy, a lot of this has come up on our college campuses around the country. Joining us now with more on that is Dottie Morris, Associate Vice President for Institutional Diversity and Equity at Keene State College. And Dottie, a big welcome back. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. How are you today?
I'm fine, Dottie, and I appreciate you being with us. I know this is a busy time, not only what happened in Virginia, but also you're getting ready for a new academic year. Mm-hmm. I wonder how you are going to be approaching these conversations on your campus, Dottie, given what we saw in Virginia this past weekend.
Well, our clan, and I have to first start off by saying I feel so honored to have such amazing people to work with me and alongside of me at King State College. We're planning to pick off where we left off last semester. What we did in February is we had a campus-wide teach-in where students, faculty, and staff participated in numerous dialogues and workshops, and that really did help to promote a sense of community among us. We are planning to pick up with those conversations. We're planning to have another teach-in, capital-wide teach-in in September. Several people are pulling together. Last year, we were calling them candid conversations. This year, we're calling them courageous conversations. So our idea is to listen to think about the number of ways that we could have teachable moments with our students.
And do all students have to attend these courageous conversations? Because sometimes these events happen and there's like a singing to the choir element that happens.
No, they're not required to attend. And what we do is the topics are often compelling enough that the students will attend. Faculty members and staff members encourage students to attend. Faculty and staff attend these conversations. They're weekly conversations. That was it's led by a person by the name of Forrest Seymour on our campus, and several of us are part of the committee that come up with topics. And so those conversations have really been provided some insight into some things that we need to do on campus, and then it leads to further conversations for students to be able to express what they're really feeling and express what they need in order to be successful.
And we talked a lot about, you know, free expression, free speech, what's protected,
right,
what isn't earlier in the show, Dottie. And I wonder, what would Keene's policy be if a white supremacist group wanted to hold a rally or meet as a college club? Would that be protected free speech at Keene State?
Well, you know, as you know, this whole idea around free speech, it's a very complicated issue with a lot of nuances to it. We do have measures in place in order to create space for free speech to occur. And we have certain expectations that we have of each other when it comes to how we speak to one another.
Can you give us a little bit more on Dottie? That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Expectations about how people will speak to each other.
Yes, we don't restrict speech, so I want to make that perfectly clear. But we do make sure that we have an understanding of the impact that language can have on other people, and we provide an opportunity for people to examine what does that mean if I say something, and if we if someone has a reaction to it. So that's why it's so important to have people on campus who are capable of helping students navigate the complexities of having these types of conversations, of navigating the complexities of understanding what is being said and the impact it could have on their behavior. So we have several people on campus who are well-equipped to do that, to help the students navigate those conversations, and also to help the other faculty and staff and as members and administration to navigate those type of very complicated, nuanced discussions.
Well, Dottie, thanks as always. We really appreciate you being with us.
Thank you very much, and you have a good day.
That's Dottie Morris, Associate Vice President for Institutional Diversity and Equity at Keene State College. Gentlemen, lots of people who want to jump into our conversation, including an email I just got from Reverend John, who says, please include the Muslim community in the list of religious groups during the discussion. Muslims are seriously subject to violence, intimidation, and misunderstanding. So, Reverend John, thank you for that email. And to our callers, Ian's calling from Chester. Hi, Ian. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Wonderful conversation. I'm very glad to hear the questions being directed toward toward faith-based communities, if you will. And as an elder and as a teacher myself in a admittedly white, admittedly completely white community church here in Chester, I just kind of wanted to throw my two cents in regards to how we as the church should be responding to this. So, you know, over the past couple of days, I've been reading a lot of articles, particularly on social media.
I think we just lost you. I do apologize. I hope that he can call back. I think he was starting to make a great point, again, as a leader in the faith community. So I hope you call back. I'm very sorry about that. The number 1-800-892-6477. Up next, Rhea in Dover. Hi, Rhea. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just calling. I just want to hear what your panel has to say about their thoughts on, like, the next steps. You know, this rally happened. It was terrible. For me, it was very scary. But what do we do now? As I would obviously go to a counter protest, but even that to me is scary because I don't know what would happen. And with this administration not condemning it as harshly or as quickly as I feel like it should have, just their thoughts on where we go from here.
Yeah, the president did condemn it, Rhea, in fairness,
just
to make that clear.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Just not as fast as I would have expected for something so serious as this.
So next steps, and everybody here wants to jump in. So go ahead, Bishop Hirschfeld, you first.
This might sound too facile, but we're living in a society where our neighbors have become strangers, where there is a great distrust and lack of affiliation with communities of transformation, I would call them. I sort of want to say, get back to church or go to the synagogue or go to the mosque. We need communities that are alternative communities to hatred. And we need to come to a place where we can have honest, self-reflective, self-critical conversations in a context that's safe and transformative. You know, I feel like these hate groups are coming because there's a moral and spiritual vacuum that's developed. And
well, I read something that some of these young men, because it's mostly young men,
right.
A lot of them didn't learn their racism from their parents. They learned it on the internet. I know personally of one example of a woman whose son was making anti-Semitic comments, and she was horrified.
And Dylan Roof
he didn't learn that from me.
Right. And Dylan Roof, the perpetrator of the massacre in Charlottesville, that's another example.
So to our caller Rhea, who says, "What's next?" You would say, go to church.
Go to church, go to the synagogue, go to the mosque, go to the coffee shop if that's where a community of, where you can find a community of love and honest conversation that is transformative.
Not an online community.
Exactly. And that moves you from a place of fear and hatred to a place of civil engagement.
Okay, but then again, and I know I want to hear from you guys too, but then again, there's this preaching to the converted factor.
Right.
So.
Yep, we're in a rocky territory here in New Hampshire.
So everybody goes to church, but everybody who goes to church is already, you know, they're kind of already on the same page with you.
I guess I'm speaking to those who are feeling, as our caller, frustrated, perhaps disconnected.
I see.
You know, there's a sense of comfort and strength that it was experienced, for instance, in that space in Concord on Sunday night, where folks probably didn't know each other until then, and they were lining up after the service, saying, "What's next? How can I be engaged?"
Reverend Jackson, how would you answer Rhea's question?
I would answer Rhea's question, especially for somebody who's very honest and transparent in saying that, you know, I'm not too comfortable going to a protest. I think the work of justice while going to a protest is and engaging in nonviolent direct action in, going out there to the state house and raising your voice, holding the signs, transmitting that message. I would say, but I think the work of justice is more than just that. That's just creating awareness about the issues. But I think the real work takes place in our everyday lives in our communities. So for someone like Rhea, I would say educate yourself, educate your children, educate others about the context, the struggles, and about people who are marginalized, the people who are oppressed, people who the groups such as these, the alt-right and the white nationalists condemn. I would say be in relationship and be in community with those who may be Muslim, who may be of color. Because I think out of relationship, I think when you build relationship and you understand your neighbor and you can actually authentically love your neighbor, you can actually stand up and defend your neighbor.
Go ahead, Rabbi Boris.
Thank you. I wanted to say the same thing, but also expand just a little bit. And that is, we can't assume the moral development of our children or of the next generation just because they're in college and they're educated. We as a democracy really have a responsibility to continue to educate and to provide effective education and provide space for even these horrible views to be expressed so that we can hear them and we can work with them. The individual who drove that automobile into that crowd had espoused those views as early as, I believe, as the freshman in high school, the suspect, that is. And you know, that's the time to start working with that individual. And I think the one thing that we all have in common is that we are a civil society and we are dedicated to educating the next generation. And beyond just giving them the tools, the economic tools, but the tools to function in a democracy. And I think that that's critical for us. And that's something that we can all join together.
All right. Well, we could talk for another couple hours. We've run out of time. I really want to thank everybody so much for being here, especially agreeing to come in quickly at the last minute. Reverend Jackson, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you.
Likewise.
Reverend Eric Jackson, pastor at Brookside Congregational Church in Manchester, president of the Greater Manchester Branch of the NAACP. The Right Reverend Robert Hirschfeld, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
It's an honor to be here.
Bishop Hirschfeld is Bishop of the Episcopal Church of New Hampshire. And Rabbi Boras, good to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Rabbi Edward Boras of the Dartmouth College Hillel. Also serves as the rabbi for Congregation Kol HaEmek in the Upper Valley. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Interns Alana Pearson and Edie Allard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.